Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
What do you do when your job is to make light of the U.S. political process this year? Do you laugh or do you cry? Larry Wilmore on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal, the 14th of July. Today, Thursday. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. We have done a whole lot on stocks and bonds the past couple of days, trying to make sense of the vagaries of those markets. So today, something a little more tangible, a little more real, perhaps. Commodities and the down-to-earth goodness of the laws of supply and demand. There are signs the long slump in oil prices might be ending. Emphasis on the might here, as we should really do every single time we mention oil prices. $45, almost $46 a barrel today instead of the high $20-something dollars a couple of months ago. Forecasters have started cautiously using the words market balance as the global oil glut starts to melt away. So as I said, might is key here. Some American drillers, though, have started betting on those higher prices and are putting drill bits back in the ground. And that includes fracking, which used to be crazy expensive, but is getting more efficient and affordable by the very day. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
4 years ago, it cost around $60 to drill and frack a barrel of shale oil in southeastern Texas. Now it's around $40, says Bielenis Villanueva. She is a North American analyst with Rystad Energy in Norway.
It was the underdog a couple of years ago, but now shale is really one of the main sources of supply for the global picture.
How did American drillers get so cost skinny? Well, when prices plunged 2 years ago, they went into survival mode, slashing payments to rig operators, workers, water haulers, everyone.
Definitely, they have been able to renegotiate the contracts, the rates, everything within a very short time.
And the frackers got more productive. Every rig drilled more wells in the ground. The holes went deeper and further. The Americans innovated. And just in time. You know that world oil glut we've been telling you about for 2 years? It's ending, says analyst Pavel Melchanov at Raymond James.
Now that oversupply is reversing and is actually giving way to an undersupply. In other words, global inventories for petroleum are actually starting to shrink.
Low prices are boosting demand, and there's more driving, so we may need more oil. Old wells are declining, so we may need more oil. And many producers have stopped investing during the price bust, so yes, we may need more oil. But even if U.S. fracked or tight oil comes back in a big way, R.T. Dukes at the energy firm Wood Mackenzie says that won't be enough for the whole world.
Even as we add up how much supply there is in the U.S. and OPEC and other areas, you can't get there with just OPEC. You can't get there with just tight oil. And we actually don't think you can get there with the two together.
Which would mean even higher cost oil might come to market. Crude that's pricier than U.S. shale. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Speaking of costs and prices, as Scott was, there is this. It looks like spending on healthcare is going to keep on growing as a slice of the American economy. In a report out this week, federal officials project that by 2025, fully a fifth of our economy, 20%, is going to be devoted to healthcare. That news comes as prescription drugs are becoming a bigger and bigger share of where our healthcare dollars go. So as Dan Gorenstein reports now from the health desk at WHYY, it is no wonder there is so much energy and time going into efforts to change how we pay for drugs.
Let's get something straight. Drugs can do miraculous things. Northwestern University economist Craig Garthwaite says, take the drugs that cure hepatitis C.
The one thing that we don't talk enough about is that what this does, by spending money on a cure, we're not spending money on other medical services later in people's lives.
Over the last year, pressure on the pharmaceutical industry has intensified to justify its profit-maximizing business practices. Industry executives, time after time, say the more their companies make, the more they can go after the big game: Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, cancer. The problem, says Dr. Peter Bach at Memorial Sloan Kettering, is many of these treatments are already hard to afford, but then drug makers keep aggressively raising prices. Federal data show a nearly 10% spike from May 2015 through May 2016, one of the highest jumps of any product sold in the U.S. over that same period.
Pharmaceutical corporations are in total control of the prices they charge for their products, and they no longer restrain themselves at all when it comes to sticking prices on their products to increase their revenue.
To be sure, some pharmaceutical executives even question common business strategies within the industry, like efforts to block a new class of generic drugs. While some practices are controversial, Harvard economist Amitabh Chandra says he's not surprised to see drug makers take advantage of the moment.
The pharma companies are doing exactly what we are telling them to do. We're telling them we have an infinite appetite. Feed us. So they're feeding us.
Chandra says until we limit that hunger, the price of drugs will only know one direction. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The hot stock on Wall Street today was the one Molly Wood and I were talking about yesterday. Ticker symbol LN Line, the Japanese messaging app, up as much as 36% at one point as it went public. On the major indices, more record highs. Details, numbers, you know the drill. Today in Brexit, a little monetary policy. This morning, the Bank of England took its first whack at interest rates since the vote. The UK is leaving the EU, but rates are staying right where they are at a record low of 0.5% for the UK. There was a whole lot of guessing, actually, that there would be a cut, given all the uncertainty that businesses in the UK are going to be facing. The BBC's Andrew Bumford went to Birmingham to hear what one manufacturer is expecting.
Acme Whistles has been going for about 150 years. From right here, more than 6 million whistles are handmade each year and exported to 119 countries. 40% of exports go to the EU.
This is our press shop, and the power presses that you can see here are stamping out the individual component parts of brass that will eventually be assembled and make a whistle. And
this whistle is the Acme Thunderer.
Well, the Acme Thunderer was actually the very first sports whistle in the world. They were invented in 1884. Before that, the referees used to run the length and breadth of the pitch, shouting and waving a handkerchief.
And that's Simon Topman, who runs Acme Whistles, employing 70 people.
Dave over there is actually assembling and testing our sirens. It makes that great whooshing sound. Used very much today by bands and orchestras as a sound effect. If you listen to music by the Beach Boys, for instance, you'll regularly hear our sirens being blown. We sell a very great number of dog training whistles right across Europe. We sell police whistles right across Europe. Different countries have different styles of whistles for their different police.
So what are the challenges, do you think, that you're going to be facing now as Britain enters Brexit negotiations?
Early days, of course, but we're going to have to watch very carefully currency movements, which will be very important. At the moment, the pound is falling fast and heavily, so that is making our products cheaper. But are tariffs going to come in? We don't know the answer to that. If tariffs come in, that will make us more expensive.
Given that all these things are often sort of swings and roundabouts, your products right now are maybe 10% cheaper, if 10% tariffs were slapped on, would it actually make that much difference?
No, if it really worked out like that, no, it wouldn't is the answer to that. But then there's the other side to it. We import our flat brass from Italy. We import our precision brass tubing from Germany. We will have to pay more for that. If our currency falls, then those component parts rise. So there's two sides to the equation. This is the Acme pig grunt and squeal. All of this is disconcerting to a manufacturer like us, who has to keep men busy, machines busy, in order to keep our overheads level and to keep us making profit.
Simon Topman, hoping that squealing sound isn't something we hear from boardrooms in coming months.
The BBC's Andrew Bumford in Birmingham, England for us. Taking a regular family vacation is one of the markers of middle class in this country, of being comfortable, of having enough and maybe a little bit extra, too. But for nearly a quarter of Americans, it's been more than 5 years since they've taken a week-long vacation away from home. That's from the latest version of our Marketplace Edison Research poll. And I should be clear here that the vast majority of upper-income families do get paid vacation, and they take it year in and year out. It's when we slide down the income ladder to people making around $50,000 a year, to hourly workers, and to those with less education, that the vacation habit kind of peters out. From our desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that story.
Fort Collins, Colorado is a hard place not to at least think about taking a vacation. It's a tree-lined college town at the foot of the Rockies. You can see the mountains right from town, national parks, world-class ski resorts, hiking trails, and cute little bungalow colonies are all within a few hours' drive. Sarah Williams, age 30, has lived here with her husband for 5 years, but they haven't gotten out of town much.
We've never taken a trip just the two of us anywhere.
They couldn't really afford a honeymoon when they got married, and in the 5 years since, they haven't taken a vacation either.
I think in a few years, once we get our student loans paid off and our car paid off, you know, we'll be able to start putting money towards that.
We're sitting out on Williams' back deck on a breezy summer day. She and her husband served in the military and went to college on the GI Bill before buying this comfortable suburban split level. It came with a bigger mortgage than they thought they could afford on his income as a software engineer and hers as an office administrator.
There's really not any extra to take vacation. We wouldn't really be able to go anywhere, and so it kind of just seems like a waste to just stay at home.
Though she admits that's stressful, because they work hard and stuff happens, like the car going kaput, and they need to relax. Our survey data show that people who haven't taken a vacation in 5 years or longer have a much higher level of economic anxiety than those who manage to go away on vacation regularly. It's familiar territory for Sarah Williams. Her salesman father never made enough to save for leisure.
You know, my dad, he worked really, really hard to help support all of us. There was only one family vacation that I can remember. We went to this place called Jellystone Park for at least a couple days. We never wanted for anything, but didn't have much extra.
Now, many middle-class American families used to take regular vacations. Historian Patty Limerick at the University of Colorado's Center for the American West calls it the democratization of recreation, from the New Deal in the 1930s through the post-war boom years.
By the mid-20th century, you don't have to be from an elite corporate family, but you can have a dad who's working at a factory and making quite a significant wage, and the gasoline's affordable, and you can car camp, and there's a whole proliferation of tiny cabins.
These days, that's harder to manage for people in the struggling middle class, those with household incomes in the mid-five figures and stagnating, says Limerick. Many work hourly or part-time jobs and don't get any paid vacation or holidays.
You can have a father and a mother working minimum wage, or they have tight constraints on how much time they can take away.
In fact, our Marketplace Edison research poll found that hourly workers vacation significantly less than salaried workers. Ditto those with a high school diploma or less, around 40% haven't vacationed in the last 5 years. Meanwhile, going on vacation turns out to be one of the main ways that Americans define themselves as middle class. Here's Kim Parker of the Pew Research Center.
It's right up there with owning a home and higher than having a college education. It's being able to have a predictable schedule, and you can make plans ahead of time and execute them. And that's all part of this luxury of being able to afford and take time out for a vacation.
Back in Fort Collins, I asked Sarah Williams if she does ever manage to sock away some savings. What's her pie in the sky?
Scott, that's my husband. We've talked about it. I would love to go to Europe, like Scotland. Lush and green and beautiful, and there's so much amazing history there. That would be an awesome vacation, but it's so expensive. Even just the airfare, the hotel and the food, and yeah.
So maybe they'll have to settle instead for a Rocky Mountain road trip in their not yet paid for brand new car. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
So take a second and tell us how you define a vacation. Do staycations count? What about traveling for weddings or other family obligations? I frankly vote no on those. You can tell us on Facebook at Marketplace APM. Coming up,
there's always the laugh at the, oh no, what's going on?
Larry Wilmore of The Nightly Show straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 134 points today, 0.7%, 18,506. The NASDAQ gained 28 points, about 0.5%, 5,034. The S&P 500 up 11 points, 0.5%, 21.63. The IPO for LINE Corporation, the Japanese messaging service, sent a huge happy face emoji to the markets, up a whopping 26 from its open. Last year, it had over $1 billion in revenue, by the by. Also making the market smile was JP Morgan Chase. Earnings were good, up 1.5% today on the shares. All eyes now on banks reporting tomorrow. Citigroup up 2.5% today. Wells Fargo up 1.3%. Delta Airlines was cruising at a higher altitude today with solid earnings up 3.5%, fueled by cheap fuel. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.53%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Despite all the hubbub today over who Donald Trump might or might not choose or have chosen as his running mate, and the frenzy we are all in for over the next 2 weeks during the party conventions, the fact is it's a long haul till November the 8th. So we are going to take some time between now and then to just talk. Talk to people who are observers of our world from all points on the political spectrum. And today, with somebody who has the often difficult job of trying to make us laugh at it all. Larry Wilmore is a comedian. He's an actor. He's a writer and showrunner. And since 2015, also the host of The Nightly Show on Comedy Central. Larry, good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
Give me the thumbnail sketch of how you see your job, other than just commenting, right? Other than just pointing out the craziness.
We go a little further on our show. We try to take the underdog's point of view. We always try to do, as I say, keep it authentic, keep it 100% real. What is the real story under here? What do we really want to find under here that is the truth of something that we want to talk about? You know, those are the underpinnings of what we do on our show, as opposed to just making a random joke about something, you know.
There will come a time, my guess would be, in the next couple of months as this election progresses, where you will have Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton sitting in front of you on the set of The Nightly Show. What's the first question to each of them?
By the way, that would be awesome.
Well, they'll make the rounds. You know that. You're up. You're
Are
an
you
A-lister,
saying I'd have them on the same show at the same time?
No. Separately.
Oh, okay.
It's not like we're doing The Nightly Show debate, right? We're doing, you know, you with each of them, and they're going after the demographic and all that, right?
It depends what just happened. Trump says things every single week. I will probably be reacting to the thing he said like
true.
2 days. It's true. The thing that he said 2 days before that is something that I can't believe that he said, even though he said he has said things months leading up to that I also believe that he couldn't say.
All right.
That's
all
what
right.
you ask Trump.
All right. Fair enough.
So like you say, Trump, how are you still in this? How is it possible?
And his response would be interesting. What do you ask Hillary?
I don't know. I'd want her to really, really tell the truth about something. I think that's what I would get her to do.
How's that going to work, though? Because
I don't know. I try to get her to be as honest as possible about something and see how that goes and have fun with that. I would choose different subjects where, you know, where you have to be truthful about all of these things.
Yeah. What do you do, though, when, you know, so the saying is tragedy plus time equals comedy.
Yes.
Right? What do you do when the tragedy comes? And obviously, I'm not talking here about just the politics in this country, but about the events of the past, you know, couple of weeks and month or so. What do you do when the tragedy comes like every night, man?
It's really tough. There was the shooting last year in Charleston, South Carolina that was horrible. And we just wanted to talk about how it was being covered and, you know, made a show out of that. But it was very difficult. It was a tough day on everybody whenever those types of things happen. You know, it's not easy to do, but, you know, it's part of the challenge of our job because we like the news shows, are reacting in real time as they happen. And we know that people are at home have experienced those things themselves by reading the news and watching the news and that kind of thing.
Newt Gingrich said something the other day after Dallas and Baton Rouge and St. Paul
And I want to get your thoughts on it. He said, you know, normal white Americans have no idea what it means to be black in this country today. You buy that?
Absolutely. I don't think you can. It would be unusual if you could. He's right. I agree.
So what's the way through? I mean, as a guy whose job it is to sort of observe this society.
It's tough to say because people have said over the years, well, we need to have a conversation. And then you have a conversation and people say, you're racist. How dare you have that conversation? You know? So is it legislation? Is it conversation? Is it people, you know, dying off and new generations coming up who don't have that phony view or whatever? I mean, some of it's probably that, you know, and views change over time, too. So I think it's going to be a combination of a lot of different factors.
Huh. Do you ever look at Al Franken, who made his name writing for Saturday Night Live and being on TV as a comedian and say, and now he's a senator, obviously. You ever look at him and say, man, I can do that?
Oh, God, no, I would never want to do that. I mean, I give him a lot of credit. I mean, he was a guy who obviously believed in a lot of causes and stuff. And you know how they say, well, why don't you put your money where your mouth is? Mm-hmm. And that's what he wanted to do. If you care about things, there's a lot of different ways to do that. And I kind of like the way that I'm doing it. I don't think I'd ever want to be in Congress or the Senate. I think I would go crazy.
Back at the beginning of this campaign, it was, I think it's fair to say, a comedian's delight, right? There was almost too much material for you guys. Do you now, a year
plus? The material
plus
was writing itself.
I know.
Which is a huge benefit because you can lay off your writing staff. They can collect unemployment for a while. You know, and you say, sorry, guys, the material's writing itself. We don't need you for a while.
Here's the question, though. Are you still laughing? Is it still writing itself?
Well, it was always scary. Let's be clear about that. I mean, there's always the laugh with the, oh, no, what's going on? I think it's always the combination. You have to learn to laugh at all these things. I mean, that's our job, too. So we have to find the jokes in all of it, no matter how scary or dark things may appear.
Larry Wilmore, you know him from The Nightly Show. Larry, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
The Ghostbusters reboot is out this weekend, the all-female reboot, I am obliged to add, because that has somehow become something of an issue with this film. The original came out in 1984, a time when movies and the movie industry were quite a bit different than they are now. Fewer superheroes, more rom-coms, those are pretty obvious. Other differences, though, are more subtle, like, just for instance, the way working women are portrayed. Hadley Freeman is the author of Life Moves Pretty Fast, The Lessons We Learn from 80s Movies and Why We Don't Learn Them from Movies Anymore.
I've always loved 80s movies. About things like the depiction of female characters and social issues, they are amazingly progressive compared to American films now. Women are often equal to the men in their professions. You don't have a woman being less powered than a man in a job in an 80s movie, even in couples. Think of movies, for example, like Baby Boom in particular. Baby Boom is about a high-powered executive called JC, played by Diane Keaton at her most high-poweredness.
Your managers are effective, your workers motivated. According to your data, your margins could be the highest in the industry.
And she inherits a baby from a cousin who dies. And this causes total chaos in her world. Because of inheriting this baby, she's not made partner. Her boss makes it clear she can't really stay at the bank. So she leaves and moves to Vermont to live in a farmhouse. And while she's there, she invents gourmet baby food, and she becomes incredibly high-powered again, and it's about what happens then. There's a lot of reasons why movies don't talk about these things anymore. The main reason is that movies are no longer just made for America. It means that studios are really thinking, will this play in China? Will this play in Russia? And as a result, they often are very conservative in their messages. Instead, they have superheroes. You really don't see high-powered women in movies today unless they are being horribly or being brought low in some kind of humiliating way. That's not how women were depicted in movies even in the 40s. But now we have a much more retrograde vision of women in the workplace.
That was Hadley Freeman. Her book is called Life Moves Pretty Fast, The Lessons We Learn from 80s Movies and Why We Don't Learn Them from Movies Anymore.
This final note on the way out today, in which, no matter how you feel about her, you're going to have to admit that Hillary Clinton made a pretty good joke. At a rally today in Virginia, the all but certain Democratic nominee tapped into the cultural phenomenon of the moment.
I don't know who created Pokemon Go, but I'm trying to figure out how we get them to have Pokemon go to the polls.
Come on, right? Pretty good, even though it is a little bit of a dad joke, right? All right, we're out of here. The Dow Industrial is up 134 points today, 0.7%, 18,506. Yes, a new high water mark. The NASDAQ up 28 points, 0.5%, 5,034. The S&P 500 gained 11 points, about 0.5%, 2,163. Ditto on the watermarkage. John Buckley, no, I don't know what that was. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.